to the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. On this week's episode, we begin a new series on Mythbusters with Dr. Duncan Peters. First, he addresses the correct girth tension, the right boots and wraps, horse selection, and appropriate use of bute and other painkillers.
We're going to talk about some Mythbusters in equine sports medicine. We're going to keep it kind of light. Didn't want to make it too serious along the way. Oh, we'll start out here. Something relatively simple. You should tighten your girth to be able to get a hand, flat hand between it, it and the horse. Well, they've done work in this area, looking at tight girths and performance. An Australian research team compared a variety of different types of girths, as well as different levels of tightness associated with the girth, and they worked horses on treadmills at a gallop to a certain level of tiredness. And if anyone's ever seen a horse on a high-speed treadmill, they basically monitor their heart rate, and you have a standard exercise test, and you can tell when the horse is getting to maximum output or a certain level of output, and so you can make assessments of that horse along the way. And so they use girths that had different materials, as I said, and also different levels of tightness associated with them. And the results were that all elastic or elastic insert girths were better than solid girths, leather, or canvas. Yeah, that sounds pretty logical. That doesn't sound like too much of a problem. But the more loosely applied girths also gave a longer run to fatigue type of times on the treadmill or this exercise. So when you go there and crank that girth up to make it as tight as you can, you may be affecting your horse's performance. And that's what they actually found on these treadmill tests. And certainly girths are becoming more and more innovative in terms of how they're being used and the designs. If you go to any saddle shop or look through some of the catalogs, certainly you'll see a wide variety of that. And basically what this told us is that expansion of the thoracic cavity for circulation and respiration is very important in these performance horses. And we talk about horses that may not be running on a treadmill, but are working in an intense atmosphere or some pretty good duration of time, and certainly it can be a factor. And horses do have a preference, they also found, for particular materials. Some horses tended to respond better to leather, and others tended to elastic. And you, again, there's a variety out there. And so if you, you know, sense some type of concern with your horse, with your tack, or the way they react under saddle, you know, just looking at something as basic as that may make a difference in what happens. As with anything, we said, you know, you'll fall off if you have your girth too loose. It's always a balance between that tightness and that stability that you're looking for. And the other thing that was interesting in that study is that when these horses finished, they would loosen the girths or not loosen the girths up. And it was very, very interesting that had a big effect on their recovery times. So once your horse has gone through his workout, it certainly doesn't hurt. So loosening that girth certainly can be beneficial there. What about tightening the girth from the non-elastic side? You don't get it too tight, or you don't unbalance the horse from always tightening it from one side and putting pressure across, or the girth that only has elastic on one side. You see people on the elastic side tighten it up, but you go to the other side, it can be a little more difficult to get that tightness or that snugness. Well, that's been looked at also. These people in Belgium looked at this. And to determine if tightening the girth from the right side varied the pressure with elastic or a flat leather girth, elastic on one end or elastic on both ends. And it did not make a difference with the leather, flat leather, or with the elastic on both ends. It didn't make a difference whether you tightened it from the left to the right side. The pressures were exactly the same. The total girth pressure was reduced when it was tightened from the non-elastic end. Okay, so again, you can't get it as tight. You just can't get that pressure if you're doing it from the solid end of the girth. That's versus the elastic end. And it also required more force to obtain the same tension or pressure under the girth when it was tightened from the non-elastic end. And I think we all probably know this. If you try to tighten it on that right side on a single-sided elastic, it's a lot harder there to tighten it and try to get the pressure or get the stability there. And overall, the girth pressure equilibrated no matter what you did within a couple of steps. So even though you did get some increased pressure, it didn't really matter. The horse moved, everything shifted a little bit, and the pressure disappeared, and it was completely equilibrated across the face of that girth. So you can tighten it on the right side, but it may not be quite as tight as if you did it from the left side. So in terms of looking at some of these girths, this is sort of the newest fad. The Fairfax girth, everyone's heard of it or heard a little bit about it in terms of it was kept secret before the Olympics by the British team, so the word didn't get out. But they looked at gait analysis to evaluate movement with the Fairfax girth, and they found that they improved forelimb protraction to about a third. They reduced the peak pressures that were involved around the chest cavity by as much as 82% with the same stability. And they said, basically the ads and the gait analysis and some video analysis, that it increased hock flexion, improves gait symmetry in terms of jumping horses. They have a jumping girth also. It increases their power at takeoff and improves jumping neatness. So horses actually jump better was their claim. I don't know if all these things are true, but the fact that they kept it a secret probably means something. But there are a lot of girths out there.
In this next segment, Dr. Peters discusses the correct use of boots.
I'm going to use some boots to support my horse's legs and reduce tension on its tendons and ligaments. We've all used support boots or some kind of boots to hopefully take a little strain or stress off the horse's legs and what we're doing with them. How effective are these boots or the working wraps in terms of providing support for these horses? There are a lot of them out there. Again, look through the catalogs or go through any horse expo, and there are a whole bunch out there in terms of availability. Well, we looked at research on providing support on basically 1,000-pound horses, working on a treadmill again, and using force transducers within the wraps, and in some cases they were actually implanted under the skin in some of the studies in order to see how much support they might give in terms of those structures there. There's actually fairly little effect there until you get down into the professional choice sports medicine boot, which is sort of the sling boot that has a wrap that comes down under the fetlock and comes back up and tightens it up. And a lot of the newer boots that are coming out are using the same type of technology to try to support the fetlock. And so polo wraps, basically very little. The racing rundown bandages that we've always talked about in the past, horsemen have talked about giving a lot of support to these horses that are out there training and going fast, really provide almost no support for them. Open face boots or splint boots, as you can imagine, with the buckles or the Velcro, very little effect. And then if you looked at even down at a stable wrap, a standing wrap on the horse, very little effect in terms of providing support. So overall, they don't provide a great amount. But is that 1% important? It may be. That's always the question. If you get 0.5% here, 1% there, these things can make a difference in a score. They can make a difference in a jumping class. They can make a difference on cross country. And so it's hard to assess in a lot of cases the benefit of some of these. But overall, they do offer some protection from bumps and bruises and trauma and things like that. But they provide very little in terms of support for the most part. They have to be kept clean, kept in good repair to have any benefit. And a big factor on some of these boots is what gets underneath them and starts to cause irritation. And this is also true with the material that you use. Some of the plastics will heat up quite a bit underneath there. Some of the rubberized boots will also, and they can potentially cause some problems, especially on some sensitive skinned horses. There are some new boots coming out that are hinged. They also have this support apparatus under the fetlock. There's a boot coming out called the Hoso boot, which is made out of some NASA type materials. It's supposed to be very lightweight but very supportive, and it's got the sling type of support. So there are a lot of things out there to try to provide more support to these horses, but these things, I think you need to assess, you know, what you're truly looking for. If you're strictly looking for protection, you know, a good pair of just good-fitting boots will do it. If you're looking for support, make sure you have some good evidence that it can provide it.
And now Dr. Peters considers the selection and evaluation of a competition horse.
Okay, I looked at a young horse to buy, and he's terrific, but he doesn't have the greatest jumping style or dressage style or movement. But I can fix that, can't I? So of course there's been work done in this, trying to predict, you know, where horses are, what they're going to be in the future. And this one particularly looked more at the jumping style, but there's a series of ongoing studies in the Netherlands determining the jumping style change in foals up to 4 years old. And they were trained with and without riders. And they looked at basically these foals early on, just in a jumping chute. They followed these horses along as they developed. They went through training periods, a basic training period, similar to the 100-day test, that type of thing. And they did certain stepwise progression and evaluated these horses along the way with a series of essentially horsemen judges, and looked at the style and what they thought was good style or a good jumper in this case. And they looked at, they used cameras and computer modeling and things like that to help with that. But the interesting thing was that they actually took different evaluators and looked at the same group of horses along the way. So there wasn't a bias from one spot to the next as these horses were followed along. And what they found out was each horse had a distinct style that didn't change from 6 months to 4 years of age, even with training and same riders. So the people that were working with these horses were the same group over that period of time. And as I said, they had different groups of evaluators, and basically they picked the same horses to be at the top that were considered a good jumping style, and they basically ended up with the same list as they followed these horses along, indicating that, you know, these horses that probably, when you initially select them, what you have is what you've got. And can you improve that? Well, that's always the question. But in general, at least with this particular study, there wasn't a big change in terms of what was being done with these horses. So basically, some of the ideas behind this is, you know, you make your selections as you're looking at a horse on a desired style that you feel is going to be good. A horse that probably has a bad trot is always going to have a bad sort of trot. A horse that has a tremendous canter is probably always going to have a tremendous canter. You're going to be able to make, you know, some adjustments and some refinement of that, but you're not going to take a, you know, as it was found in this particular study, you're not going to take a bad jumper and make him good, per se. You're not going to improve him dramatically through that whole evolution process. And no one's yet done this with dressage horses. I think it would be a nice thing to follow a bunch of dressage horses along within a controlled environment like that and see what happens in terms of how they progress over time in terms of their determination of their gates. Certainly, you're probably going to have a little more of an effect, I would think, in terms of the training and the development of that. But probably the basic gates we all talk about are probably not going to change too much. And I think probably a lot of people have already realized that and know that within the dressage world.
The final topic in this episode considers the correct use of bute and other painkillers.
My horse had a mild lameness that improved about 75% with bute. I think I'll give him more bute and make them all better. So, bute or more bute? Well, Oklahoma State looked at this and they compared two doses of bute on a group of horses with chronic forelimb lameness. And basically they used essentially 2 grams for a 1,000-pound horse or 4 grams for a 1,000-pound horse. So 2 tablets or 4 tablets a day. And they did force plate analysis as part of the lameness evaluation to determine the improvement in that lameness. And basically there was no significant difference in the lameness scores with the higher dose administered. Okay, so the 4 grams is no better than 2 grams. 2 grams basically is an anti-inflammatory effect, tends to work very well, and 4 grams is not necessarily better, that's for sure. There are others, non-steroidals, or bute-banamine, ketafen, naproxen, were not as part of this study, and those studies haven't been done. But the USEF study recently compared bute and then adding banamine on top of it, and they used a model with a horse that had a set screw that you could put a little pressure on their sole to cause them to have a little bit of soreness. Just like if someone put a little stone in your shoe, you know, you're going to protect your movement a little bit. And they did force plate analysis, and with the bute and banamine together, they did not get any increased benefit from one or the other alone. So another nice thing to know that by just adding another one doesn't necessarily, in that same class of the non-steroidals, doesn't necessarily improve your chances of improving the lameness or decreasing the inflammation. So basically, a little may be good, but certainly more is not necessarily better. And most people are well aware of the risks that are involved with either chronic bute or non-steroidal administration, or with higher doses. And we've seen horses that come through the clinic that may get, you know, for some reason, by mistake, someone says, you know, give 2 grams of bute a day, and there are 3 people working in the barn, so 3 different people give it 2 grams of bute, so it gets 6 in that one day, and we see it in the clinic, and it's got renal failure. So, you know, those things can certainly happen, and some horses are more prone to it than others. At one time, it was routine that horses would live on a gram or 2 grams of bute a day. Some of the chronic lamenesses that people had in their backyards, and a lot of those horses did fine if they were out in pasture or moving a little bit or, you know, grazing, not necessarily in a stall confinement. They did okay, but certainly we know now that higher stress levels and confinement, which a lot of our horses are more inclined to do now, end up with more of these risks associated with the non-steroidals. So gastric ulcers, as everyone's aware of, and also colitis, or large colon inflammation, is probably one of the biggest ones now, and that we appreciate more and more with even the lower levels that we have to be aware of. And again, the bottom line is the condition's not responding to, you know, what's been prescribed or the normal amount of medication. You probably need to reevaluate that and get your veterinarian involved. Yep. The question is, what about Prevacox, which is a COX-2 inhibitor, so it doesn't have quite the gastric and mucosal potential problems as the non-steroidals, the other non-steroidals that are COX-1 and 2 inhibitors. And we found that we haven't seen the side effects. And a lot of horses, we use it, particularly for horses that we want on an anti-inflammatory like that for 30 days. You know, usually about that 3 to 4 weeks, we tend to try to take them off for a period of time, give them a little break, but there's nothing we haven't seen the major side effects that we do with the other non-steroidals. That's a good question, yeah. And you probably don't use the Prevacox in your horse, right? You use the Equiox all the time?
Yeah.
The Prevacox, for anyone that doesn't know, is the dog formulation. That is, Equiox is the paste, which is runs you about $7 a day to give. And the Prevacox is the exact same drug in a nice chewable form that costs probably between 20 and 30 cents a day to give. So that company's selling more Prevacox for dogs around this country than anything. And actually, we had a sit-down with them, a bunch of veterinarians, a little round table, and said, why the heck don't you have the oral form? And they said, well, we didn't do it labeled that way. And that's basically, they'd have to go back, redo the whole thing, and the cost involved with that would probably jack the price of the pills up. But unfortunately, there are some potential liability factors with using the Prevacox. If your horse is insured and there's something that happens related to any hint of Prevacox, there's a possibility that they're not going to cover whatever that is, whatever that claim is. So there are some potential hazards, and there are certainly hazards at our end as veterinarians in terms of a liability issue. We prescribe ferrocoxib now. We don't prescribe Prevacox too much. We prescribe ferrocoxib, which is the medication, and just say, well, you get it whatever form you can. But there is definitely a liability for veterinarians in terms of doing that. So a lot of them are very reluctant to write a prescription for you to get it from Farm Vet or from Valley Vet, things like that. And that's understandable, because those things do come back to get us as veterinarians, unfortunately. But it is a good drug, and we use it long term that way, and we have not seen side effects related to it.
This series was recorded at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. For more educational information from this and other conventions, please visit eTrack at usdf.org. The 2014 Adequan USDF Annual Convention, presented by SmartPak, will be held in Cambridge, Massachusetts from December 3rd through the 6th. These podcasts are available for download on iTunes and at usdf.podbean.com. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.